Shifting gears now, Richard Dolan is well known to listeners of this program, one of the most important writers and authors about the UFO topic. His UFOs and the National Security State, Volumes 1 and 2, among the most important UFO books ever, I think. And he plays a key role in getting together and putting out, publishing the book we're going to talk about for the rest of this evening, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. You know, in our country, we say that we protect whistleblowers. We have laws to protect whistleblowers because we want to encourage people to come forward, to tell us, to spill the beans about government lies, about subterfuge and corruption within the government, all kinds of skullduggery. But the fact is that whistleblowers have a pretty rough time of it. When they come forward, bad things happen to them. The same is true in the area of UFOs. The whistleblowers who've come forward voluntarily have not been treated well, in part because many of them who step forward with wild stories turn out to be bogus, hoaxes, liars. But some of those who come forward are being truthful, and they suffer for it. When we come back, we'll be talking with Richard Dolan to introduce us to this new and important book, and then Grant Cameron will be joining us in just a little bit. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Dolan, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. You class the joint up. Give us a little bit of credibility.
Thank you, George. It is always nice to talk with you.
Let's talk about whistleblowers in general. I don't know if you heard part of the introduction a moment or so ago, but it's not a good time for whistleblowers. You know, it seems like when these guys run for president, Bush and Obama, they all want to say the same things, where I'm going to be the most open president ever. And then they get in and they love secrecy. I mean, it was bad enough under Bush. It's been worse for whistleblowers under Obama. Talk to me in general about, as an historian, looking at whistleblowers. I don't know that I would encourage people to come forward anymore if they wanted to spill the beans on something bad.
You and I agree completely on that score. I remember, you know, 8 years of George W. Bush feeling like the nation was getting beaten over the head by a national security apparatus that just was intent on stealing away every single individual liberty and right to privacy that we thought we had. And then we thought, oh, well, okay, a new president, maybe things will be better. And no, it hasn't gotten any better. There is... Effectively, I see no whistleblower protection that's going on anywhere in the United States government. So if you other than certainly nothing relating to military or national security, you have zero protection.
And then you throw in the inherent weirdness of UFOs, and somebody who would come forward knowing something about that, they're really asking for trouble.
You could be out of a job. You could be liable for prison time. I mean, we don't know how bad it could get, but there is the protections are just not there, and the promises that were made by both of those presidents have been broken badly.
You and I have both had this conversation with Colonel John Alexander, a friend and colleague of mine who lives here in Las Vegas, who said, oh, come on, it's exaggerated. People can come forward and nothing's going to happen to them. And, you know, I think he cites a couple of examples. Well, how would you respond to that a UFO whistleblower? Go ahead.
Read some newspapers, or you know, go on the web and search out the news. All you have to do is basic web searches for what's going on with whistleblowers today, and I think that just proves the lie to it. Not that he's lying, but it's a mistaken claim for sure. With UFO phenomenon, it's never been an easy game. You know, throughout modern history. People have been subjected not simply within the government, but to career pressures of all types, whether in or out of government. If they have a professional position, if they have too much of an interest in UFOs or abductions or anything like that, there's a long history of professional individuals who've suddenly been out of work or even blacklisted from their community. Within the national security apparatus, we're in a dangerous position now. We've got laws like NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, which literally gives the military the right to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens without trial, without habeas corpus, and a whole host of other stripping away of our rights and of our privacy. The National Security Agency has a data collection center in Utah that's got every single email that you have ever written, George, and even if you don't have it, they have gotten it. And if you want to get it, maybe you can go knock on their door and ask them. They'll probably tell you you don't have a need to know. So that's where we've gotten to in this world today. And it's a world that I think the founders of this great country would say has gone upside down. It's not exact at all what they would have wanted.
Well, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's worse with UFOs. I think your point is well taken.
Let me tell you, I'd like to get some of those emails I've written back. I'll go knock on the door and ask them maybe one of these days. The lack of an outcry is what bothers me the most, is that where is the outrage by the public about what has happened to various rights? You mentioned about the indefinite detention without charges, surveillance of everything.
I think there is an outcry. I think the problem is it's not an organized outcry. Maybe that's what it is. Certainly there's a lot of angry people about what's been going on in the U.S. and also elsewhere in the world. It's not only the U.S., but the U.S. really does lead the way. I think there's a lot of unhappy people. I speak to them every single day, but I think what you have is a feeling of powerlessness. Like, what can I really do about it to fix it? So I might as well just, put up with it and shut up, duck my head and get in line. And I think that's really what's been happening, really, since 9/11 in this country.
You know, you and I are of the same mind in one regard, is that you're an historian, I'm a journalist, and whether or not aliens exist, I mean, neither of us or other researchers can go out and corral an alien or know where something is going to land or a craft is going to appear. We don't know what's on their mind or where they're from. But we can study the government's response to this whole thing, and that's really what's always interested me, the sort of combination paranoia and schizophrenia in responding to what the government has always told us is a bunch of fantasy.
Absolutely, and what we find in the long history, really from World War II onward, I think schizophrenia puts it very well, because you have a situation where, just go back 70 years, pretend that you're on the national security team of Harry Truman, and you find out that all of this is real, that let's say Roswell did happen or something like that, where technology was recovered. You've got this awesome, incredible reality now to deal with. What do you do? Do you tell the world? You might want to, but of course, if you do that, then you suddenly are going to be probably sharing this technology with a lot of other people you don't want to share it with. So you have to make some very important decisions right off the bat to keep this concealed, and maybe decide to revisit it every so often and think, well, maybe we'll tell the world in 5 years or 10 years. But of course, what happens is that secret just develops its own momentum, its own power. And so there is this schizophrenia where within the classified world, this topic is incredibly important. I think it's the single most profound issue that they deal with at deeply classified levels. But for that reason, it must be handled so that the public does not get too worked up over it, because this really is a revolutionary topic.
Let's talk about this book. Cameron, I've sort of known him for a long time. He's not a superstar in the UFO world, but people who are in the know in this topic, who've been around it for a long time, really respect the guy, because he does his homework. He works really hard. He's tenacious. He runs things down. So I'm sure you were familiar with his work, let me
just tell you, I consider Grant a superstar in the UFO research world. Always have. This book that I am publishing, my company, Keyhole Publishing, I don't just write UFO books, but I do try to publish them. And in fact, I've got a very big year in 2013 for publishing, including another book of my own. We'll talk about that some other time.
Okay.
But I was approached some time ago to republish this book that Grant and another author, Scott Crane, co-authored about 20 years ago. And this was a particular book. At the time, it was called UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government. And for those of us in the know, this was a classic study. Really, what it was an attempt back around 1990 to confirm or deny, but really to find out what is the truth of the MJ-12 claims that were then a brand new thing within UFO research. And for anyone who doesn't know, I mean, simply MJ-12 is an alleged control group at the very top, the most powerful men who were charged with managing the entire UFO cover-up. And the question was it true? And this is what Grant and Scott looked into. And let me just say, they did a superlative job. The problem was, back then, that book was published by MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. It went through an edition of 1,000 copies, that was it, and it just never got anywhere. I think it was something that researchers knew about, no one else did. For me, this was a highly coveted book in my own research when I did both of my volumes of history, and it's extraordinary. Grant will be able to tell you exactly why. I can tell you a bit why, too. But when I was asked to republish it, I said, look, I would love to do this, but I want to do it on one condition, which is that you guys really update the book and bring it up to speed. I mean, you wrote it in 1990. It was great at that time. It's still a good book, but it could be so much greater if you update it, 2011, 2012, 2013, when we were talking about all this. And that is what they did. That's exactly what they did. So the result, I will just say what I believe is that this is the single, possibly the single best book, best I've ever read, dealing with inside government leaks from credible sources about the reality of the UFO phenomenon. And it's very powerful on that basis.
It's like it's not necessarily for the UFO beginner, although it could be, but it's more like a grad school course, isn't it? Because I mean,
that's a good way to put it. I think that's about right. It's not like intro to UFOs. On the other hand, if you have any little bit of sophistication, any little bit of education, I don't really think it's necessary to have a long background on UFOs to really dig your teeth into this book. It's one of these books, if you have an interest in government secrecy, it seems to me that this is of great interest. If you're interested in government secrecy but you've never done UFOs, then strap yourself in and be prepared for a wild ride, because what you find is that there are some heavy-hitting people at the very top of the national security pyramid who appear in this book who are quoted at length about the reality of UFOs, about the reality of an ET presence here on Earth. And some of this is quite startling. The whole book really evolved out of this attempt years ago to confirm MJ-12. And what Grant and Scott Crane did was to kind of walk through some of the more interesting leaks and inside stories that were current back then and then also today. Back then in the 1950s and 60s, there was a Canadian government employee named Wilbert Smith. Some researchers know a lot about him. Wilbert Smith was fascinated by UFOs, and back in 1950, really early on, he was in Washington, D.C. at the Canadian Embassy, and he got a meeting with a top-level U.S. scientist in a conversation about the flying saucers that were then being discussed. For a long, long time, no one knew the name of this scientist, but during the 1980s, it was discovered. Scientist's name was Robert Sarbacher. Long after Smith had died, Sarbacher was still alive, and Sarbacher was found by some researchers. And again, this book covers all of this story. When Sarbacher was found to be questioned about whether he actually spoke with Wilbert Smith, to the great shock of all the researchers involved, Robert Sarbacher said, "Oh yes, we did actually talk quite a bit about that. And as a matter of fact," this is like in 1983, "as a matter of fact, I heard many, many stories about these other beings and about crash retrievals." And I mean, this isn't just some guy off the street. Robert Sarbacher was a heavy hitter, one of the top power scientists in the U.S. establishment. So this book, among many other fascinating things, covers this whole Smith and Sarbacher saga, which is incredible, but it really focuses then on a fellow named Dr. Eric A. Walker, who Sarbacher led the researchers to this man. Eric Walker was president of Penn State University for many years, but he was much, much more than that. He was a very good friend of President Dwight Eisenhower. He was head of what was known as the IDA, the Institute for Defense Analysis, maybe the top military think tank in the country. Walker was powerful. Sarbacher led researchers to Walker, and then Grant and Scott and several other researchers began having discussions with Eric Walker. And Walker started to talk. And it's a series of fascinating interviews that are recreated in this book. And it doesn't get old reading it. Every time I read it, it just blows me away.
It's cat and mouse kind of, it's an intrigue. You know, field is, it's so weird. You've got spies and lies and disinformation. It's always hard to figure out what's solid and what isn't. And we know that some of the whistleblowers who've come forward are liars, especially in the Roswell case. Some of those guys were completely making stuff up. The same thing happened in the Area 51 state. So the difficulty for people like you and Grant is to figure out who's worth following and who isn't.
Well, I think you said it for sure. And in the case of Eric Walker, he did play. He was really coy at times. But the impression that I've gotten when I've gone over all of the transcripts is that Walker was caught a bit off guard. Because keep in mind, when he started talking, the MJ-12 documents were a brand new event. This is 1987 when they really came out. And Walker was informed that his colleague, Dr. Robert Sarbacher, had been talking. MJ-12 is out, and what it appears, if you really read through these transcripts, is that Walker initially said way more than he probably should have said, and that's what really got this whole thing started. That's my take on it. Your point is very well taken. You never really know, and you say something, then you pull it back, and then you say something else, and you pull it back. And this, by the way, is a very important concept that Grant and Scott bring up in this book. And I'm sure Grant will talk about it, but the idea of a limited hangout. And I think this is the theme that really informs the entire book, which is very simple. If you're on the inside and you've got this big truth that you want to get out, if you think that at some point some of it needs to get out, and there are people, I think, on the inside who feel this way, the question becomes, how do you do it? How do you do it without destabilizing the whole system? You throw a little bit of truth out there, but then you run away from that truth and deny it so that it doesn't cause the whole apple cart to come crashing down all at once. And as a matter of fact, what Grant has in this book is a long statement by Dr. Christopher Green, Kit Green, exactly to that effect. And no one knows, Kit Green was a top-level CIA consultant scientist for many, many years. Had given briefings to President Ronald Reagan, knows many, many other very high-level people in the national security community, and speaks in this book at some length about the whole concept of this limited disclosure, limited hangout.
Bottom line, after you read this book, you know, so many of the skeptics, I should call them debunkers instead, they're not going to believe it regardless. You could have the proverbial landing on the White House lawn and they wouldn't believe it. But any reasonably intelligent person who reads this stuff, you would have to say that these statements from these heavy hitters constitute proof.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it does. I would say it constitutes very, very powerful evidence, and maybe that's the most careful way I would want to put
evidence,
it.
Evidence, yes.
Absolutely a powerful statement. I'm very proud of this book, and, you know, as the publisher of it, I went through every single page of it over and over many, many times, did a lot of editing of it. The research was never a problem. The writing was always good, but I really wanted this book to shine, and I'm so happy about it. This book will be available starting tomorrow. I wanted it to be available tonight, but unfortunately, it's just one of these things about publishing, but it will be available by a link at keyholepublishing.com. I would encourage anyone just to go check it out. I'm 99% sure that link will be live then. They'll be able to get it easily in North America or Europe or UK and elsewhere in the world, but shipping is very, very easy for those regions. This is, in my opinion, a new classic. And I can't tell you how excited I am to be associated with this book. Ed and Scott both are just very professional.
I agree with you. It is classic. And I hope you'll come back and tell us what other projects you've got coming this year. You have an open invitation, Richard.
Well, thank you, George. Well, I have a new book of my own coming out in about 2 months. And I'm very excited about that. But we'll talk about that when it's ready.
I appreciate that. Richard Dolan, thanks for joining us. Grant Cameron, author or co-author of UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants, joins us when we come back. Crashes play a big role in what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this program, specifically UFO crashes, allegations about Roswell and other incidents, and the people who may or may not have known the inside truth of what went on. Grant Cameron has spent a big chunk of his life, more than a quarter of a century, tracking down these stories, trying to find, separate wheat from chaff. The UFO field, of course, as listeners to this program know, is filled with people who have wild stories, and some of them prove to be completely bogus. So separating wheat from chaff is often a tough thing to do. It's a steep learning curve. And Grant Cameron, as Richard Dolan just told us, is one of the stars in the UFO field, known for his meticulous work in tracking down truth and figuring out who's telling the truth. And he's this new book is a monumental work. We're going to jump right into it right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Grant Cameron and Scott Crane have cranked out a new book called UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. It's taken a long time to put it all together, but it'll be out tomorrow. And it's highly recommended for anybody who considers themselves to be any kind of a serious devotee to the UFO topic, because it really does track down some intriguing leads about the most interesting mysteries, MJ-12 documents, Roswell, and other crashes. Who's believable and who is not? Grant, it's great to have you back on the program.
Well, thanks, George. It's an honor to be on. I would do part of a book, and then I get to be interviewed by a guy who actually made Area 51 famous. And so it's an honor there. And it's also an honor because, over the years, you've been in this a lot of years. And I think the majority of the stories that I sort of deal with, you've followed it. You've been sitting on the sidelines watching this whole thing. And so the names and the places and all that stuff is familiar to you. And that's fairly rare to get a reporter who's as well versed on what we're going to be talking about.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of this territory that has a familiar ring, that's for sure, and we'll get into that. There must be an incredible sense of relief for you now to have this thing done after so much time.
Yeah, it dragged on, and even in the last couple of days, it was sort of like, I guess it happens in research where you're sort of trying to track down different things. Richard would bring up this or that, and you're trying to track it down, and suddenly you find new stuff, and there was actually three or four things that happened in the last day or two that never even made it into the book. It just sort of like a waterfall, just kept going. And finally we had to sort of put an end to it. And we just sort of shut the book down, but there's actually more material that has come out since a couple of days ago when we finally shut it down.
Well, that's the most fun, isn't it? Digging up the facts. The writing is hard. It's digging the stuff up that's fun.
Yeah. I'm really not that interested. I always usually try to get a co-author to write up my stuff. That to me, that's the part is whether it's doing lectures or whether it's doing research for a book, that's when you sort of discover things that you really hadn't seen before. And one prime example is like when we were doing the Area 51. This is actually a book that was published in 1991. And in there, we sort of were chasing you around back in 89, 90 when you were breaking the Area 51 story. And we put it out. So when I was redoing the book, I was sort of updating the book from the 1991 version. I was reviewing the Area 51 thing, and I figured, well, it looked pretty good. We seemed to have it. There really nothing's changed over 20 years. And then I started to figure, well, I'll check all the interviews. So I went through some of your interviews with John Lear and Huff and all the various audio interviews that you can now get on the internet. And suddenly all this new stuff that that popped up that I had never known before. And it was almost like a whole rewrite of the chapter. So,
well, that part of it is great. I enjoyed it. And reading it this weekend brought a lot of things back to my mind that I'd forgotten about, details about that wild time. Mm-hmm. Tell me this. Give me an overview. What you think the impact of the book is? I mean, you look at the statements from some of these heavy hitters that we're going to talk about one by one. Things that they say about the reality, what the government knows, and you'd have to say that constitutes evidence of some sort. Even for skeptics, if you read this stuff and you hear these people and you realize who they were and how credible they were, it has to constitute evidence of something. But evidence of what? What's the big picture now that you've finished the writing?
My big picture of the thing is it comes down to a lot of people. What will happen is in the UFO field, I find that what happens is a story will come out, whether it's the Area 51, the Lazar story, or whether it's the MJ-12 story, and people will sort of look at it and they'll sort of go along, and then suddenly somebody puts out that it's a hoax, and they find some problem with the story, and everybody just sort of drops the story and races and looks for the next new story or the next video, and all that stuff just sort of gets thrown on the sidelines. And what I found when I went through the whole thing, I've come up with this theory that really it's not disinformation. Like a lot of people say it's disinformation, like Bill Moore putting this stuff out. What I found that it is that the government has been disclosing this kind of stuff. And so the material that is coming out is not disinformation. It's information that they are providing us, and they're covering it with a bunch of garbage, a bunch of disinformation. And I can give you the prime example to me is I live in Canada, and in Canada, the Canadians were also involved in UFOs back in the 50s, and they pulled out of the UFO field about the same time as the Americans pulled out of the UFO field. And the Canadians basically said the same thing as the Americans. This is not a threat to national security. There's no credible evidence that ETs have visited the Earth. And the Canadians just sort of packed it in and went away. And I've been at this for 40 years, and I seriously could not tell you whether the Canadian government is involved. There's absolutely no indication of any department. I would have no idea where to file an FOIA in Canada or to try to get any information. In the United States, it's completely different, absolutely different. And to set this up, in 1969, the U.S. Air Force shut down Project Blue Book, and they shut it down right before Christmas, when all the reporters had gone home in Washington. They shut it down. It was basically the same thing. No threat to national security, no ETs visiting the Earth. And the story sort of died. And then in 1972, they were in a situation where the PR nightmare was over. They never had to talk about UFOs again. The American government wasn't involved. And then in 1972, they contact Alan Sandler, Bob Emenegger, and I say this is potentially the most important story in ufology because it explains what happened with MJ-12, with Area 51, with Chase Brandon, with all these stories that would come out after 1969 when they shut Blue Book down. They could have just gone and watched NFL football, Dancing with the Stars. They never had to talk about UFOs ever again. So why in 1972 would they contact Sandler, who was a film producer in Los Angeles, and Bob Emenegger, who is vice president of Gray Advertising, and say to them, we want to do some documentaries. They call them to Norton Air Force Base, where they keep all the military film. They take them into a clean room, which is a CIA clean room, where the CIA was doing documentary stuff for training films and stuff like that. And they take them in, and here's the government that says, we aren't involved. They're out of it. They don't have to talk about UFOs again. And they say, Paul Schartle, who is the security manager, says to them, we want you to do these documentaries on holography, 3D holography, and working with dolphins and all these different military things, and then said to them, and the other thing we'd like you to work on, but we'd like you to sort of bury it under all these other documentaries, we'd like to do a documentary on UFOs. What would you think if we told you that at 6 a.m. in May of 1971, a flying saucer landed at Holloman Air Force Base, and that aliens got out, were greeted by officials from the Air Force Base, and that it was filmed from three different angles by the U.S. Air Force. Now, here's the government is not involved. They bring in these guys who are highly credible, and the story that they tell, I say it's the best story. They basically walked into the Pentagon. They talked to Bill Coleman. They didn't sign in at the Pentagon. They went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Everybody that they wanted to talk to, they were allowed to talk to. They were allowed to go on Holloman Air Force Base, wander around, do whatever they wanted. They put out this documentary. They were offered this film. They had the film in their possession, this film of this landing. And Paul Schartle went on a documentary later and described what was on the film. And the last minute, they pulled the film back. And so that's the sort of the blueprint of what happens all the way through the next 40 years. Is that the government puts the material out, they're telling the true story, they pull it back, people sort of flush it and say, oh, well, it's just a hoax, it's just this or whatever, and they go on to the next story, and yet the story got out. And the whole idea, the whole thing that I say that they're doing, whether it's Emenegger, whether it's UFO Cover-Up Live, MJ-12, is that they are putting the material out, they're putting the information out, but they're keeping the cover-up going because the cover-up they need to be maintained because there's classified material. There's material, whether it's dealing with mental phenomena, which, of course, the CIA would be very interested in, this ability to control people with your minds that is you see in the UFO stories by abductees, or whether it's the technology that's involved with the flying saucers that you can fly these things around. So that part they need to be maintained. But there is this sort of split that people want the information out. So they're leaking the information, but they're continuing to keep the cover-up going for the classified aspects of the phenomena that they need to maintain for national security.
Yeah, the significance of that, just to reemphasize it, this guy Emenegger and his partner, they're not chasing UFOs. They weren't there to ask questions about UFOs. It's the government that foisted this on them, not the other way around.
Yeah, and Bob tells the story numerous times, and I have very good friends with him and his wife, and his wife was very much into it. He said he was like he couldn't believe when they said this was UFOs. He says, this is nonsense. I mean, my wife is talking about, you know, alien babies and stuff, and suddenly the government is telling me this is for real, and he was just shocked. And they signed a contract. This was not some, you know, rinky-dink thing. They actually signed a contract in the Pentagon to do this. And they were told that they were replacing another film operation out of the Pentagon that had messed up on the Pentagon papers. And I was given the name of the company. And because this company had messed this thing up, they were called in to do this sort of stuff. And they had a CIA agent on the set the entire time that they did this production. They had the MacArthur Foundation, John MacArthur, put up $250,000 to do this documentary, and then at the very last second came in and said, "Oh, my friends are giving me a hard time. I don't want my name on the credits for this documentary, but you can keep the money." So there was these kind of things. And the more you hear about that story, and for example, they were given a bunch of top secret f film. The Holloman Air Force Base film was pulled back, but I can confirm that they still have a top secret film. They still have in their possession that was given to them in 1972, 73, during that period, that shows a launch out of Vandenberg Air Force Base and UFOs flying around this launch. They had the film. They never handed it back in, and Alan Sandler still has the film. So this is the more you hear about this Holloman story, about this thing that when it started in 1972, the more you realize that they were given incredible amounts of material, and you know, had Bob Friend go on camera because the CIA guy, Arthur Lundahl, who was running the Weird Desk, said, "Bob, I'm still on duty. I can't go on film." But they tell this story that they didn't have to tell about the CIA channeling an alien in 1959. And that story, because I'm a Canadian, I know that because the Canadians were also channeling the same alien. So this is a story that they didn't have to tell. This story was put out, and yet when it comes down to it, it's a documentary. Everybody sort of forgets about it and says, "Well, you know, it was kind of an interesting documentary." And when you see the depths of the story and what actually happened, you realize that the government is actually trying to put material out.
A slow release, sort of a controlled release, over time. They use people, whistleblowers, if you want, and they have the option to discredit those whistleblowers and make them look ridiculous. But overall, it seems to be what a lot of people have suspected for a long time, that they're telling the story in tiny bits and pieces over a long period of time.
Sure. I always refer to it like they have a trap door for all these things. I really don't think there's any whistleblowers anymore. I think that everybody who comes out as a whistleblower is working for them. That it's like you get a guy who'll say, "Oh, I've got secret information," and he calls himself Commander X or Mr. X or something. And everybody in the UFO community sort of figures that this guy is now a whistleblower, and he's running around telling all these stories as if the government can't figure out who he is. I mean, the government can figure out who this guy is in 30 seconds. I mean, they monitor all the email, all the phone conversations. They would know immediately. And so I think that anybody who's running around as a whistleblower is actually somebody who is there to hand out material. And there's always a trap door, like with the Lazar thing. It looks good, and then suddenly he's got a bad background. And the thing that really keyed me into that he was part of the same thing, that this was part of the same thing, was when you did the interview with John Lear and Huff, and John Lear talks about the fact that there was three interviews, that Lazar went for three interviews, and in the second they were all technical questions, and he aced it. He knocked it out of the park, except for the first question in the second interview. And the first question in the second interview was, "What's your relationship to John Lear, and what do you think about him?" And so when you hear that Lazar, in the first interview before he ever went onto the base, was asked about John Lear, gives you the whole story. They knew that he was in contact with John Lear, and anybody who knows, you were there at the time, you know John Lear was the state director for Nevada for MUFON. he was in charge of the convention that took place the year after. He had been on the base in 1977, taking a picture of the MiG in front of the hangar, so they knew who he was. He was running around Las Vegas making speeches about aliens and underground bases, and it was the perfect setup. It was like, here's a guy with a bad background that they knew that would fall apart. There's a trap door that when the Tsar went public, that it would fall apart. So they get the material. He goes onto the base. He gets all this. He comes back. He immediately tells John Lear. Then he's on the base, and they give him 125 documents. And you know the same, that John, that Lazar was only on the base for a couple of days. If you add up all his hours, he was not there very long. And yet they give him 125 documents on every aspect of UFOs to read. And he runs back and he tells John Lear the whole thing. And the material is getting out. So then when it comes out, the thing falls apart and everybody says, oh, Lazar, he's missing two master's degrees. It's all nonsense. And everybody just dumps the story. They run off and chase the next UFO story. And the whole story about Area 51 gets out. And where they, I think they miscalculated on the Area 51 story was that in majority of them, and I've had lots of these stories, where you get a story and you try to get the thing to go, and you have the three-day news cycle. That the reporter, for example, the Chase Brandon story, Lee Spiegel did it. 3 days, he had 1.5 million hits on the website for that story. But he had to go on to the next story. He had to do another story. He ran off, he did the next story. And the Chase Brandon story, as much as we tried to keep it going, just died. And everybody just forgot about what Chase Brandon had said. In your case with Area 51, is you did this long 6 or 8 month investigation. You started getting more witnesses. You had a lot of high profile in terms of putting the videos out and stuff like that. And they miscalculated. And suddenly you had all the people with the buses going up to Area 51. They had to take more land away to stop people from getting up in the hills and looking down over Area 51. And they just miscalculated. What I think they thought was going to happen with Area 51 is he would go, John Lear would tell the stories. Nobody really believed John Lear because he was talking about aliens eating people and underground bases and all sorts of weird stuff. The idea would get out. The story would die. Everybody would find out about the problems with the story. Nobody would believe John Lear. And the story would get out, and the story would quickly die, and we would get the story out. But they miscalculated what was actually going to happen in terms of your investigation of Area 51.
Well, meaning that they thought I would give up.
Yeah, and it's the same thing if you take a look at I talk a lot about Pandolfi, who you followed as well. This is the guy that the New York Times calls the top scientist in the CIA in 1996, and he's been dropping all these UFO rumors for years. And how does he do it? He's putting it through Dan Smith. So whenever I talk about him, I talk about Dan Smith, and people immediately, it's the same as John Lear or Lazar, is to say, oh, Dan Smith, the guy's a drunk. He gets thrown off of chat boards. He's a totally crazy guy. You can't believe anything Dan Smith's saying. And that's where they have the trap doors. You're putting stuff out right there through bad channels.
Well, we'll come back. Grant, yeah, that music tells us we need to go to a break. We'll come back. We'll jump into the Area 51 story, Lear and Lazar, and later get into some other whistleblowers who were reluctantly came forward with stories. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM.